Hello and welcome to Access All Areas with Dermot and Felicity. I'm my way access Dermot Devlin, and with me always is the chronically fabulous Felicity McKee.
We've been away for the last 2 weeks or so, so apologies for that to all of our listeners. I had a period of illness, more so than usual, where I had to go into the hospital briefly. And I know, Dermot, you had a little bit of ill health in the last week, but that sort of comes with having a long-term health issue. So sometimes we just have to make a change of plan suddenly.
But we're back now, and we're going to go straight into the new discussions. So Felicity, what we chat about today locally?
Well, I do believe you were involved in a new report about the impact of coronavirus on people, specifically disabled people in Northern Ireland.
That's correct. I was one of 400 disabled people here in the North who took part in the Disability Action NA report to find out the impact of COVID-19 on disabled people here in Northern Ireland. Some of the things that were highlighted were to do with the mental health and emotional well-being, something to do with care, accessing food and medicine, accessing information that might need to be needed, and maybe what the impact of employment and training is on disabled people, as well as the social security and benefits and the community support that's available. So we're able to find out some information on what was happening. So for example, when you look at the mental health and emotional well-being, something that I know is very important to you as well, Felicity, that of the 400 people, 72% of the people that responded felt that their mental health and emotional well-being was affected by COVID-19. So, and whenever they had those people that maybe had pre-consisting conditions, that it was made a lot more worse, it was more impactful. So they felt anxious about contracting COVID-19 and the possibility of being isolated from family and friends and not being able to access a GP or mental health team. So that's the issue. Like out of 400 people, over 400 people, 72% of disabled people felt that their mental well-being and emotional health was affected. So I'm sure, like, this happened to me, the anxiety level, particularly at the start, and when we come to like March, April and June, was sky high. And I think you probably felt the same, Felicity.
I think yes and no. So, I mean, there was obvious anxiety, and I did have to have some quite grim discussions about what happens if I do get sick, and say if I am in ICU and nobody can come to be with me, because people were dying alone at that point. And also because with me being in Wales, if something happened to me, how would my remains get home? So there were discussions along that. But I think overall, and it may be the experience for some people, I have found that it didn't impact me in certain ways that I thought it would. And this may be because I've experienced being in hospital sometimes for long periods of time, where I can't get out and I can't necessarily do the stuff that I normally want to do. And so I had a lot of practice with that. And I think some disabled people would probably say the same about their experiences, because we don't live in a world that is accessible. And so, unfortunately, there are people who don't get out as much as they would like to be able to. And so it's a varied mix of experiences. I do think, though, overall, the fact that there were so many people who were saying it's only the sick and the old who will die really is what got to me. And I think it wasn't that I felt that my mental health as a whole was impacted. I think it was more just like the soul-crushing idea that society as a whole devalued my life. So yeah, it's tough, because like I know that my mental health, I think, stayed relatively stable, but I think there were other more emotional factors at play.
Again, as I say, the report did cover more than sort of the emotional and mental health impact. One of the things, and we have discussed this and earlier podcast, Felicity, was accessing food and medicine. Over half of the 400 people, 57%, had experienced disruption in accessing food or medicine. Was an additional 46 people who were managing at present, but the were concerned about maybe getting access in the future. So they were having difficulty accessing home delivery and priority listing, which, if you're familiar with anybody's been listening, you discussed in great detail earlier about not being able to get into priority listings for home deliveries.
Yeah, it has been very difficult, because my GP advised me to shield, but I didn't get an official shielding letter. So I was sort of somewhere in the middle in this grey area. Some of the complications I faced was the fact that Boots decided that my medications no longer needed to be in a tray for management, even though there's about 20 of them. And as you can imagine, most days I rattle. I do require the tray, and They also charged me for delivery, even though I'd been advised to shield and couldn't go to collect my medication as usual. So there's been additional expenses and additional worries and concerns. And Boots also said that if there was a second wave, they couldn't guarantee that they would keep my medications in a tray when I finally got them back into the tray. They apparently said that because I'm doing a PhD, I appear to be managing on paper, which I don't think my GP agreed with them on that one. But it's assumptions, I think, and it's the little difficulties that people don't think about that have been really impactful. Because a tray, you probably don't think is a big deal, but when you're dealing with that many medications, it becomes a really useful and practical aid for the management of them.
Well, some other issues as well that we raised. Almost three quarters of the survey, so that's 68% of 400 people, felt that they were unable to access health information about COVID. And an additional 59% were having access to their specific health needs. So they found that while there was a lot of information coming that was very vague, they couldn't find out sort of stuff that was important for their health and was nearly impossible to access that. I know I've had experience with that as well. You know, with me being on a treatment, it had to be suspended. So I just wasn't sure what was happening. Like anybody was wondering, I'm actually starting again in 2 weeks' time, so that's great news. So I'll be back to myself then. But like, I'm actually one of the lucky ones. And once I did it, don't know what's happening with their medication, don't know when they get back on it. But even if it's not just medication, but getting access to the day-to-day treatment or information that's regarded to their disability or their health.
Yeah, and so like the start of lockdown, I had physio cancelled, which I'd been on a waiting list for. And I was told that because I'd received a leaflet, because they weren't doing face-to-face, that was going to have to suffice. Although interestingly, my local physio department is now offering physio online. They do Facebook Lives where they do Tai Chi and other physio exercises, and you can follow at home in your own time. So it's really interesting to see how, as time has gone on, some health trusts have adapted and made healthcare more accessible for some, because granted, not everybody has Facebook.
I would hope, but you see, these things are becoming more accessible for those that can access it to broadband and that. And I'd sort of hope that when the world does settle down again, that these new methods won't disappear, but there will be an additional option in the future for ones that if they can't leave the home for whatever reason, at whatever period of time that they can't, that they can still access the same health as everybody else. Some other issues have come up as well were the social security benefits. So 68% of the people in the report survey said that they had not experienced any problems accessing the social security benefits. However, 22% said that they had problems accessing benefits or anticipated there might be problems in the future. 9 people out of 400 people have specified that they've been processed of applying for benefits. You've probably done yourself, Felicity, with PAPS and Universal Credit and are appealing decisions and are still waiting for the process to be looked at because the pandemic is unfortunately slowing the process down.
Yeah, I know. I was impacted by that directly myself with PIP. My forms had gone in just as lockdown was announced and they provided no information as to what was happening. And I was left in limbo right up to the point when my PIP would have expired. And, you know, when you think about having a little bit of money to help with your everyday, you know, disability related costs and for it to possibly disappear the following week because nobody has responded to any of your outreach to them, it is a very disturbing and quite scary and anxiety inducing place to be in. And it's definitely an area that I think they need to work on, because I know during lockdown I had you tortured talking about the issues I was having with my blue badge and trying to get it renewed because of the ongoing benefits issue.
But yeah, that report sort of highlights in a way for us. You probably felt that you were sort of alone in that fight, maybe a handful of other disabled people across the UK or wherever it may be. But this report highlights that this is, it's not just a small problem, it's a large problem that many, many people who are disabled have experienced. So it's great to see that this report has come out. Now, there's a lot more that goes into great detail that we wouldn't be able to cover in the podcast today. But if you check the link before and below here, the podcast comes on, you'll be able to download the whole report. But I think the main thing that it come from this is, because it's something that I would fully support implicitly, and I've spoken about it here on the podcast many times, that does show the need for disabled people to be part of the process. So not just part of the process of trying to educate people and be part of the consultation and program about coming out of COVID, but we need to be part of the program of government. We need to have that voice, because we are almost 20% and we seem to be the 20% that people seem to forget about. So we need to be in there. We need to be part of the legislation to include that these things have to fix and that we don't have these issues in the future. As well as that, there's many, many other issues we could cover. For example, changing places, you know, like we've got some good news about that. Recently, that Conor Murphy, the finance minister here in Stormont, is looking to get this part of the building policy regulation, and he's made some funding available to make changing places available. And then if you look at within the school system, that they're trying to campaign now to get rid of seclusion and restraint within schools, because that is an unnecessary cruelty on children, and it impacts on their mental health in the future, and sometimes way into deep into adulthood. So these things need to be addressed now, and they need to be addressed in a real fashion, not just as a tick box exercise to say that we've had discussions with disabled people, but we need to be in there with a real voice and a real forum and making actual real changes, real authority.
Yeah, no, I would fully agree with you on that, especially in regards to restraint and issues surrounding that, because it should be a last resort, and unfortunately it doesn't seem to be the case. In a lot of these situations, we have to be the ones who lay the foundation for the future that we want to see. But it is an awful lot of emotional and physical labour on our part. And if we were in government and we had fully, you know, a proper representation there to discuss these issues, just maybe it might ease the workload for the rest of us, because that's not our job on a day-to-day basis. We should be able to just be going about minding our own business already in an accessible world, instead of having to quite literally fight just to be able to get into a coffee shop.
But again, it just goes back to what we've been saying all these years. Nothing about us without us.
Exactly.
So Felicity, what have you noticed in the news this week that you feel would be a good discussion point for Access All Areas this week?
So this week I was giving a presentation, and I found out that you can actually add subtitles via Microsoft Presentation. I have been looking into subtitles for presentations at university and different formats, but this is a cheap and a very affordable way that everybody can do it. And it leads very nicely into a report that I saw. So the Association of Non-Medical Health Providers have suggested that 81% of disabled students have been negatively impacted by changes to their academic work due to coronavirus. 73% have said they've had issues with access to academic resources such as libraries and workshops, and 57% have said access to their teaching has been disrupted. And this can be disrupted in lots of different ways, such as issues with captions or issue with audio. So if someone has a poor internet connection, or if everybody has their videos playing in a Zoom call, that can actually impact and affect the quality of the Zoom call if there's an awful lot of people there. And one of the final things is, not everybody actually has access to the internet. It is something that we tend to take as granted, and it isn't actually accessible to everyone. And so it leads kind of into what our main topic today is, which is disabled students allowance. I just think it's really interesting to sort of see how disabled students are generally already impacted by an educational system that has inherent ableism already built into it, and different structures that create barriers. Interesting to see how, even when they go online, these translate over, and disabled people again are still being impacted unfairly by this. And some of the things that could easily be done, like captions, are so easily done. Like I said, it's free in Microsoft PowerPoint. So these are things that could be fixed and changed. And I just think it's really shocking when we think about 73% having issues just accessing academic resources such as workshops, which would most of them are online these days.
No, that's definitely true. Like, one thing we had sort of planned to do earlier in the year, but obviously due to certain circumstances, we were unable to do the Disability Pride Week. And one of the options we had looked at was captioning, because, you know, we can't hold a Disability Pride Week with events on Zoom and exclude people who we don't have captions. And plus, finding out it's a vampire print is great, it's great. But what we were using Zoom, we just could not find it anywhere. And it built them to Microsoft Teams, which is great, but it's still, it's not ideal, but it's not a, it's a, it's a good bridging system. But things like software like Zoom and Cisco and things like that, they don't have that available. I just think that, you know, it brings back to what you're saying, that this is an option for disabled people, and yet disabled people are included yet again.
Yeah, and the thing is, some of the other options which would provide a much higher caliber of captioning aren't affordable, so you need the institution to pay for that. But the thing is, it's really good because it's not just disabled people who are benefiting from it. Say if you are in a Zoom call and someone's internet isn't good and every other word is glitching and you don't get it, on their end where they're speaking into the microphone, it's recording and captioning what they're saying, so the captions will show on the PowerPoint, even if you can't necessarily hear what they're saying, so they can still continue to present. So there's benefits for everyone if we get captions.
That just seemed to be the case when it comes to technology. Disabled people seem to be priced out of it.
Unfortunately, yeah.
Well, but I think that really covers everything about the disabled news this week. So we covered the technology and COVID and all that. So I think we will take a little break now, and we will move over to our main discussion, disabled students and allowances. So enjoy the short break, and we will see you very shortly. As we said earlier, the main discussion for today is disabled student allowance. I'm going to let Felicity take the lead this time because she is a disabled student and she knows all about the different allowances available, whereas I am an old man who is not a student, so it's not really applicable for me. But I will butt in every now and again, Felicity, and give you my 2 cents. Okay, so we'll just go over to Felicity now.
Well, thank you for that kind introduction. I wouldn't say I'm necessarily an expert, but I am quite experienced in navigating the system through personal experience, because I have been applying for disabled students allowance now. I've been in university, and when I think about it, 10 years, but I've been on medical leave a couple of times. So almost for 10 years. But disabled students allowance are basically, it's a grant that helps with any extra essential costs that you may have as a direct result of your disability. You can be eligible to apply if you have a long-term health condition, a mental health condition, or a specific learning disability such as dyslexia. And what's really good about it is Disabled Students Allowance doesn't depend on your household income. It depends on your own additional needs, and you do not have to pay this grant back. It's really good because it can help you get specialist equipment such as a computer, which will then have software on it, such as Dragon, which is a speech to text piece of software. You can get a non-medical helper, which could be, say, someone who is a mental health advisor. So they would check in on you maybe once every week or once every 2 weeks, and you can have a coffee with them and discuss any issues, and they'll signpost you. You can get personal support, travel costs, as well as other disability related costs of studying. So for example, if you had to print out an awful lot of things and have them in larger font so that you could see them more clearly, they can help cover the cost of the additional printing expenses. It can also cover sign language interpreters. So those would be for support workers and other different things. But as a full-time student, you can get up to $22,603. So this was for the last academic year. And going forward, it's gone up to £23,258. It's very good, but if you're part-time, it does go down. Now, there's differences depending on different conditions as to how much you can pull down. And there's variations on the specialist equipment. And there's just sort of different loopholes and different things. But for example, with photocopying or printer ink, you can claim for this current academic year that we're going into, so 20 to 21, you can claim up to £1,954 for printing costs. So that's not to be sniffed at.
You're a student, so would you find that this would help you as a disabled student cover some of the costs that you would incur, or do you just think it's just, is it helpful for you? Yes.
It is helpful, but you have to be aware of it and know that you can apply. So there was a Department of Education report that found that 60% of eligible students had never heard of Disabled Students Allowance. And so they're not applying for it and they're not getting it. So it can be helpful, but it has to be sort of tailored to your need. And so when you're having your assessment, so you put in a form, the form then gets stamped by your university to prove that you are a student there. And then it goes to basically your education authority, and they will then sign off on it and agree that you can pull down this money. But when you go to have your assessment for your individual needs, you really need to have a good disability advisor who knows what you can get and what you need, and really tailor it to you. Because when I first did my DSA, and this is nearly 10 years ago, at the time, it kind of felt like no matter what you had going on, they gave you a laptop, but they didn't actually ask what your individual needs were. So by the time they had got me a laptop and pulled down support, I was already going on medical leave because they'd been so focused on other things, they didn't meet my initial needs. So there is travel allowance with DSA, and I required money to be able to get to class because I physically wasn't able to manage the distance from the flat I was in to class safely, and people were having to offer me lifts, and I wanted to pull down money for taxis, and I wasn't able to because of the support I had in place at that point. And then they provided a laptop, which wasn't much use when you're already on medical leave. So it can be really useful. I think if you're going in for your assessment, it's very good to know what your needs are. Granted, it's difficult to know what is available because it varies depending on where you live. So if you come to Wales and your funding body is Student Finance England, that's where the money's coming from because that's your permanent address, because your term time address is temporary. So it will vary. So like one of the issues with England, if you are pulling down finance, especially if it's for a laptop, is that you end up paying the first £200 for the cost of the computer and any assistive technology, which if you don't have £200 to hand can be a limiting factor. And, you know, that could be the difference between rent or the specialist equipment that you need to keep in university. And the government has actually admitted recently that it is a financial barrier that had reduced uptake for the specialist equipment. And so it's a really good scheme. It's great when it works, but sometimes there can be barriers. Now, there's ways around that because most universities will have a hardship fund. So if you needed access to support to then pay for the specialist equipment, there is a way around it. But the problem is most first-year students going into university won't necessarily know about all these systems in place or how to navigate through it.
And is this available for university, or can it be open for anybody at any level? For example, could it be local colleges at a further or higher education level, or is it just specifically for university?
It's not just for university. You can get it at higher education. So when I did my foundation art diploma in Lurgan Tech, I pulled down DSA for support there. So it is available. Obviously, there are some differences depending on the different universities or the different colleges that are pulling it down and who your disability advisor is and how well they can navigate that system. But you can pull it down for both further and higher education. And it's one of those things that people don't necessarily know about. And what was really interesting was that there were people who weren't disclosing that they had a disability when they went to university. And the best way to get the ball rolling on your DSA is to disclose that, because it can take up to 14 weeks from you filling in the form to get the entire process going. So to have an assessment for them to put all the information in. And once that 14 weeks is done, they then have to contact their contractors to supply you with the equipment. So for example, I had my DSA in. I'm still waiting on equipment at the start of a new academic year for equipment that should have arrived the previous academic year. Now that has been impacted by COVID, but the best thing to do is to get the ball rolling as soon as you're in university. But the thing is, only 13% of those who apply to receive DSA are being told about it at school. One of the reasons is that some teachers and other people, even their family members, are telling them not to disclose that they have a disability because there's a fear that they might be discriminated against or face stigma by disclosing it. And I know through personal experience that this is something that I was very worried about when I first went to university. And when I went to the occupational health assessment and I explained my ongoing health issues, they told me in the occupational health assessment in University of Ulster to not disclose. And so that was one of the reasons why by the time I was getting the DSA, even though they were offering me a laptop, it had taken so long to get everything in place. So I would say, hand on heart, that people should disclose if they're comfortable to and access this, because it can make the difference between someone feeling able to continue in higher or further education and having to drop out. It's available, you do not have to pay it back, and it's definitely worth applying for.
So you, as a disabled person who has been to university, do you feel this made a positive impact for you? For example, if this student line hadn't been available for you, you still think you would have been able to go to university and do what you've done? Or was this allowance actually what made it possible for you to be fully immersed within the course?
I think the allowance has definitely made it a lot easier for me. Anyone who knows me knows that I'm probably quite stubborn at times, in a good way.
I don't know about that. Are you really stubborn?
But when I was... Actually, it was during my second attempt at my undergraduate. I had moved to Queen's University, but I had an advisor who told me that I was too disabled to be in university. And I took that as a personal affront and decided that I was going to do the best I could. And I went on to get a first. But in that particular situation, I had to go through different avenues to put the support in place. And it just happened to be that I knew a very nice receptionist who knew everybody. But the actual process of getting your DSA can be very difficult. And so, 32% of people have found the application really difficult. Another 32% said sourcing the material was difficult, and that 60% then faced costs to get the material. So it has been very helpful to me. I know other individuals for whom it has made a complete difference, in that if they did not have it, they would not be at university. So it varies individually as to how useful it is, but there's no doubt that it is useful, and that without it, people would be facing more additional barriers that are already in place in university. So like, this isn't knocking them down, this is just trying to level the playing field just a little bit.
It's interesting you say that, because you're saying that many disabled students weren't aware of this. I just wonder, because like, I've been to university, but not university, I've been to college several times actually, doing different courses, and I never knew about this. Like, I knew there was sort of granted you get, but nothing to the level of the disabled student allowance. So why is the case it not been known, and what can we do here at Access All Areas, was chronically fabulous, and My Way Access, and all these other disabled organisations and websites? How can we get the word out there? Let students know this is available for you. Sign up, let them know you're disabled, let them know that you can apply, and where to go to make sure that you're getting the right terminology, you're getting the right information across, that you actually get what you need, and on time.
So I think as people are getting their results in August and through to September, when they're filling in the forms for university and things like this, it's vitally important that that's when people are talking about this and highlighting it, because some people only find out when they're in university, or maybe when, because most schools will have a disability advisor within the school, when that person maybe floats the idea and mentions it, because it simply isn't advertised. So this is one of the reasons why it's really important that we're having this conversation now, because a lot of the universities, the first day back on campus or in virtual learning is coming up very soon. And because it can take up to 14 weeks, it's vitally important that people get the ball rolling, because you cannot get your form in unless you can get evidence that you're currently a registered student at that university. And people are enrolling right now, but obviously, if you're in the process of enrolling, you can't get the ball started. So as soon as you're in the door at university, it's important to find out how to get this the ball rolling. And like, you can put in the application without necessarily having huge input from the disability advisor in the university. What you need to do is to get evidence that you're currently registered at the university. So everywhere there will be a department, usually sort of in an administration section, which can provide a stamp which sort of says, this is this university, this is the date, and this is the student. So if you don't know the department to go to for disability or well-being or different things like that, you can make inquiries to find out who could provide evidence. So your lecturer or a supervisor can provide evidence that you're currently a student, and that can be put in with the application, because you can do the application on your own if you need to. But most universities will provide support with the filling in of the application. But I think one of the big issues with it is that a lot of students who are eligible don't think they're eligible, and sometimes it's because they don't think that dyslexia or a mental health issue such as anxiety or depression counts, but it actually does. And I know in my case, I was in university and I didn't really consider my mental health to be a disability, even though it was. And it took me a while to kind of look at my mental health in such a way where I went, this is disabling me, not only because there are barriers in place, but like the symptoms are also disabling me in a way where I'm really struggling. And because it is disabling me, it is a disability. I am disabled by this. And when I looked at it that way, I was able to really identify with the language, because prior to that, and obviously nowadays, I do use mobility aids, but at this point, I didn't. And I had a little bit of internalized ableism. And I think a lot of disabled people sometimes do have this on an unconscious level because of the way society is. But I kind of assumed disability was something physical. So like with a wheelchair, because like even with the iconography that we see in a disabled parking space, it's a person in a wheelchair. Or if you see going to the bathroom, it's a person in a wheelchair. So even though I was having really quite disabling symptoms, not just mentally, but also physically. So, like, I was having issues with fatigue, issues with pain. I didn't associate that with disability. And sometimes people don't realize because they are told they have a chronic condition or they have an ongoing illness, but they don't see that as a disability. They see it as something different. And why wouldn't you access this money that can improve your experience at university? So, like, dyslexia, dyspraxia, ADHD is covered, anxiety and depression is covered. You know, if you are partially sighted, if you're blind, long-term health conditions, cancer, chronic heart disease, HIV, they're all covered by this. So there's different things that people may not consider to be a disability, but they are a disability and they would be classed as a disability under this. And so getting people aware of it is the first battle, but I think also getting people to maybe understand that sometimes certain conditions they are classed as a disability. And it's changing that, because a lot of the time you'll see people online using very negative language about disability, as if being disabled is a bad thing. But like, I don't think being disabled is a bad thing, and I imagine you don't see it as a bad thing. And so one of the barriers is getting people to feel comfortable with saying that yes, they are disabled, and yes, they may have additional access requirements that need met to help them to be in university. Like, there's so many benefits from some of the software, and the benefits. Like, one of the things that I find very helpful is I'm doing a PhD and I'm expected to read long, long pieces of work. And it's very, very difficult because I struggle to concentrate and I struggle with lots of different things. But I can turn the text into an MP3 that can play almost like a song or almost like a podcast for me, which is really helpful. The only thing that the DSA hasn't been able to help me with is in archives when I'm looking at people's handwriting from the 19th century, because my dyslexia does not like that. And there is no software out there that can decipher what looks like chicken scratches on really old parchment.
Well, I know I'd definitely be interested in that software that you mentioned earlier about translating from the word into, as you say, an almost like a podcast, because a bit like yourself too, I can read to death as it is, but like yourself, you do get tired and your concentration to relax. And I kind of be, my concentration is higher late at night, so to be able to lie in bed and actually listen to and soak up the information would be great. So having something like that there, especially with students, you have a lot of stuff to read in what is a relatively short period of time, can make a massive difference.
Now, there are some changes that have been happening. So, the Disabled Students Allowance's Quality Assurance Group, which is a bit of a mouthful, it was an independent charity that ensured that assessments of disabled students were carried out properly at centres across England and Wales. So, this is specific to England and Wales. They were closed in December of 2019. And when they closed, there were fears that Disabled Students Allowance would become an unregulated sector, because at that point, there were no plans to replace the group that basically helped ensure these assessments. In January of this year, the monitoring of assessment centres was then passed to the government-owned Students Loans Company and the Department for Education. And they agreed to take them on for a period of 10 months from January. Now, what gets really interesting when you look at this is that Capita, which does PIP, is one of the outsourcing giants with PIP. They own and run 37 of the DSA centres across the UK. So with this happening, there are concerns about how some of the assessments would be carried out, and that those 10 months have kind of ended around about now. And I'm not too sure what's happening right now, because the worries about regulation, they weren't without merit, because as other reforms to Disabled Students Allowance in the past have shown, it's led to a responsibility for the funding of non-medical help being placed on the university. So that's note takers and study skills mentors. And I remember when that passed, because I was heavily involved in the protest against it, and I was on the Disabled Students Committee for NUS and also NUS USI, which is the Northern Ireland one, so both nationally and regionally. And the problem with passing those costs on to universities is not every university has an additional budget to provide that. And so it can lead to what appears to be a two-tiered system, where universities with money can provide these additional services and universities without can't. And so DSA is something that really needs protected. And it can be a bit complicated at times. And most universities are very good about it and will have support in, because many of them do recognize the importance of it now. But it's difficult when you look at the politics that's happening around DSA, because obviously, I think you and I would both agree it's a really important grant of money for disabled people.
Well, as listeners are probably not aware, realize that this podcast is recorded over Zoom, so Felicity and I can see each other, and Felicity can testify when she mentioned the word that Cavanaugh were involved. The facial expression wasn't the happiest look you've ever seen me, was it? But that was like a
Definitely
big red
not.
light that this is just a danger zone, and they shouldn't, it just it doesn't need to be kept away from organizations that are mean testing disabled people.
So, like, there are fears sometimes when it comes to certain things, and was it Disability News Service has an awful lot of reports on this and generally keeps on top of it. But the key takeaways for anyone who is starting university this September, you can apply for DSA. There's no deadline. So if you don't do it in December, you can do it, or no, if you don't do it in September, you can do it in December. But the earlier you do it, the better, because it can take up to 14 weeks to get that money in place and to get support going. You're entitled to it, regardless of the institution you're attending. The allowance is not means tested, nor is it repayable. And the average amount that a student gets is £500. But obviously, it can go way up to about £23,000, depending on what your additional needs and costs would be. So that would be my takeaway. If you're a student going in, If you have ADHD, if you have a hidden disability like dyslexia or anything like that, even if you don't necessarily think you're disabled, but you have a chronic illness, apply. There is no harm in applying.
Well, definitely, that's something I agree with. Definitely apply for these courses, for this grant, because it can make a difference of passing and failing for many, many people. Now, I can understand this is a lot of information to take on a small podcast. So what we'll do is we'll drop the relevant links down below so you can click and find out whether what different types of disabilities and illnesses and mental health issues are available. I can guarantee you that you probably will, if you're listening to this and if you're a regular listener, you probably will be, I nearly put my money on it, will be eligible. As well as finding out if you're eligible, we'll put the link on how to apply, who to contact to make sure you're right, what information did you need to provide. So we'll help you get there. I'm sure Felicity will agree when I say this. If you have any issues, just drop myself at my way access a tweet and we can and I can answer it. But Felicity as well, you can drop a wee message. And for both of us, you'll get one of us at one point on Twitter. We will sort of help you get to the end of the line and get the goal that you need, okay? So I think that really covers the main news this week. So we're going to take another little break. Maybe get yourself a cup of tea or something a little bit stronger. And we will see you after the break. Welcome back. I hope you enjoyed that little break. Now we're just going to be discussing some of the things that have been happening in our lives this week. So Felicity, I believe you had an unexpected share this week. Would you like to share it with us what's been happening in your apartment?
Well, as it's freshers, we have new arrivals to the university and I got some new neighbours upstairs who unexpectedly caused my ceiling to try and fall in. So I was in the middle of a conference because I have been presenting at this conference when suddenly there was a loud shout because when I went into the bathroom, you could see water coming down through the electrics, just like pouring out of the ceiling onto the floor. And we couldn't figure out exactly where the water was coming from. So I went to go and get someone to come up to go and ask around to students to see what was going on, if they could turn off whatever water they had. And the bathroom is now a bit of a mess because if you imagine a bathroom that has no windows, it depends on that one light. My bathroom is now dark. There's no light. The toilet and the shower is going to be fun. It's got this tiny little light above the mirror, but it's not the same as an actual proper light. And interestingly, the water damage has gone through to the bedroom. So we thought we got the entire thing sorted. And I could hear the bedroom light making this weird noise. So when they finally got an electrician out, I asked him to check the light. And as he unscrewed the light, another downpour of water came down and just poured out on top of everything. So
it's been an eventful couple of days then.
Yeah, my ceiling is unhappy. And also just in regards to like things going horribly wrong, I finally got rid of the builders. And it turns out that when they painted the side of the building after they were finished, they sealed my window shut, all of them. And because there is no extractor fan in the kitchen is now the equivalent of the depths of hell if you try to cook in it.
So basically you have an unwanted shower in your house and you have an unwanted sauna in your house as well.
Yeah, well, you make it sound almost nice. Like I can just go and have a, you know, a random sauna. I can be cooking and doing health, you know, health spa treatments at the same time.
That to me sounds like heaven.
Was it, we'll swap then.
Well, it definitely sounds like you've had a look at all. Maybe not what you wanted, but it's been eventful for you anyway.
I do believe, though, that your week has also been eventful because I think you went to go and see a new movie that's come out.
Yes, I went to see Bill and Ted Face the Music this week. I don't know if anybody remembers the film from 29 years ago. It was Keanu Reeves and Alex Winter about the time-traveling teenager who have to write a song and save the world. Well, there's something I had kept a secret for a very, very long time. Felicity, you know me, I find it very hard to keep secrets. I don't know how I managed to keep this one. For a split second, I turn up right at the very end of the film, in the credits, dancing and singing. In cosplay, which I love doing. for me, that was just an unbelievable experience.
I really want to get to the cinema to actually see it, but obviously with everything happening in the pandemic, I'm not sure when I'm going to, but when I do, it's going to be a momentous occasion where I shout and point in the credits that you're up there, because I now know a famous movie star.
Well, I don't know if I'm famous or a movie star, but you definitely know me. But there was another little quirky story that I didn't find out till way later. It turns out as well that I am dancing to the song at the very end. There are many, many people from all over the world dancing in a montage, but we all get a split second or 2 seconds on the screen to show that this is us. But the song is the song that the whole 3 films have been about saving the world. But it turns out, after doing my uncle and a few of them family members doing a little bit of family research, and we discovered through one of our descendants in America who was talking about the film, and it turns out the person who co-wrote the song is a member of my family too. He's a fifth generation away from me who moved to America 200 years ago. So it turns out that one side of the family wrote a song for a film, and the other side of the family was dancing to the song in the same film. It just shows you just how small the world is.
It really is, because I think they say there's about 6 degrees of separation between absolutely everyone in the world. And it's fascinating when you really look at it, because everybody's into all these sort of family tracing, find your heritage type things. I don't know if I would do it. It's interesting, but I don't know.
But not the guy in question, his name is Sean Fitzgerald, so if I want to look him up, he can keep me searching. But you say we're 6 degrees of separation, so I'm only one away now from Keanu Reeves, Alec Winter, so I'm a happy man.
I think you're one away with the movie anyway, but you're definitely one away with this new connection. It's really fascinating when we go into our family history to see who's there.
It definitely is something that I want to develop into more, because I'm not going to do much detail, but I've been trying to find an old photograph, come back maybe 2 or 3 generations. And something when I was younger I've always been interested in, but never actually done about. So to actually see photographs of my great-great-grandparents, it's unreal, because I never thought that would happen. So it's kind of given me a new momentum, a new push now to see how further down the family line and of the Tourney side, which my mum said. And hopefully start on the Devon side too and see what movie stars I can find down that line too.
Oh, well, there's been plenty of Irish famous movie stars, so you never know. There might be another 2 or 3 degrees of separation.
But you never know. We could even find out that me and you are second cousins. Wouldn't that be great?
Oh, don't get me started. I remember in school, and I found out when I did some research, and I think I was related to everyone either by blood or by marriage, somehow, distantly. It is really interesting, because like I think people don't realize just how close we are, like even just within, you know, our local communities when you go back through history.
It just shows you that there's not a wild difference between a whole lot, and like I've always been interested in who you think you are in the BBC, and from that you just see that not like low, it may seem like 200 years is a long time, but it's relatively short. And as well as that, there it's whenever you see some of these celebrities on TV, how they're connected to everybody else, which means that I don't know who I'm connected to now. You know, like we could be cousins, or I could be cousin to Leo Varadkar, or God help me, Boris Johnson.
Oh dear. I think I'd stick with Leo, although I don't know. Does anybody want to necessarily be related to like a politician?
Well, I think that really covered my local news this week. So just we'll take a few minutes now just to see like what we want to take away from the podcast this week. So basically, I was chatting about earlier on, it was about the COVID impact on disabled people here in the north. And I believe the old adage, the old motto goes, nothing about us without us. And that report pretty much puts it in writing that this needs to happen to disabled people, need an actual voice, an actual representation at all levels of government, from local council all the way up to Stormont, and of course even over to Westminster as well, because we need to have a voice at every level to ensure that what we need and what we're lobbying for has been heard by the right people, and that the right people understand why we need it. It's not just a cry because we want this. It's a matter, it's a cry because we need this to survive, and we need this to level the playing field that we are equal in life and got the same opportunities. It's not about being selfish or not about want, but it's just so we can get an equal run on life, and that's basically what I want people to take away is, you know, if you are disabled and you are looking to get involved, contact your local council, tell them what you need, tell them what needs to be done, and try and get involved in any discussion that's going on. Don't be sort of leaving this for somebody else.
Yeah, because I think we sometimes feel like we're very alone and we're not connected at times, but small changes and small impacts can have a really large ripple effect, and you never know what you do in fighting for your rights could open doors for other people to access stuff for theirs.
And again, talk to many other disabled people as well in your area, because you know, you're better working as a group and fighting for the same causes. Like, for example, here in the North, we've got a lot of powerful voices, such as Jason Olson, or Sean Fitzsimon, and you've got Christine McClellan and Bernie Drain, and of course, you've other people as well that make yourself Felicity too, of course. You can't forget about Felicity. So you need to get behind these people and lend support, because when you work together, you can make things happen and you're not going to be a lone voice. Felicity, what would you like people to take away from this week, even if it's just one lesson? Just what do you think is the most important thing?
I think it's very hard to follow after that very inspirational talk you just gave, but I think for me...
I don't agree with the way that inspirational is.
Well... The specific words you said were inspirational, not necessarily you just existing. That's a separate entire conversation we could have on a podcast, and the idea of inspiration porn. But I think for me, the key takeaway would be that Disabled Students Allowance is accessible right now. You can apply for it. And if you are starting further or higher education, get those applications in, because considering the 14 weeks it takes to get it, you want to get the ball rolling as fast as possible to make sure that you have the support in place. And you won't know yourself once you get the support in place, the additional things that will be put there, because for example, I got Dragon software. My occupational therapist recommended it for me, but it's not available on the NHS. They weren't going to fund it for me, but I was able to access it through DSA. So if you are going to university, if you are going to college, apply, and apply early.
That's very good. So I definitely echo that as well. Just get applying, get what you can to get you to university. Now, some of the things that Felicity and I are going to be working on, hopefully for October podcast, we're going to be doing little 5-minute interviews with disabled artists over the month of October, which we will be playing for you. And this will be through an installation of work that is going to be provided through the University of Atypical. So that'll be just something that you can look forward to as well. And we'll hopefully get that up and running by October. So that really covers everything this week. And as I say, I definitely enjoyed listening to Felicity. And all she had to say was today was the Disabled Student Alliance. And of course, the unexpected show. And I look forward to hearing what are the incidents you get involved with next week. But if you want to contact me at any point about any issue, any things that you've heard tonight on the podcast, or anything disability-related, or Quantum Leap-related, or Doctor Who-related, or Bill and Ted, you can give me a wee shout on Twitter at MyWayAccess, and you can also find me on Facebook and Instagram at MyWayAccess as well, or you can find me on the website, mywayaccess.com. Felicity, where can we find you?
So you can find me at McKee_Felicity on Twitter. You can also find me on Instagram at FlickNightshade. I don't use it as often as I use Twitter. And you can also find me at Chronically Fabulous on Facebook, and it's CronFabNI on Twitter. It's also CronFabNI on Instagram, I believe. But mainly you'll find me on Facebook or Twitter.
I'll definitely be checking you out over the week as well, and we'll gather up a few stories for next week. So until next week, Felicity and our listeners, have a good week. Keep safe, keep the mask on, and turn off Van Morrison.